La bête afghane. Welcome to what we call Weltaufgang, which is the opposite of Weltuntergang, which is the German word for the apocalypse. And we want to have conversations with people who are guiding us all into the good world we all like, to paraphrase Charles Eisenstein, the more beautiful worlds we know our hearts know is possible, right? So that's basically, I think, what it says. And in that, I am super happy to welcome here today Ariel. And as usual, we start with the most difficult questions of all. Ariel, who are you?
You know, it's funny because I used to teach. I've run programs for social entrepreneurs now for 20 years or so, and I used to teach people how to think of themselves through different frames based on who they're speaking with. You know, like I could tell you the story of who I am in one way if you're someone that I'm looking to work with, versus another way someone I'm looking to partner with, versus another way. You know, and in each way, it's the same you, but it's. But it's a different way of speaking. I mean, you know, I think that how I'm going to present myself today, which is not how maybe I would present myself to anyone else at any other time, is I start with that I'm a father. I'm a father of three kids who are turning 14, 10, and 6 this month and up to March. They're all born in January through March. I'm a Jew. I am part of the Jewish people and feel myself as part of that tradition and how I practice and how I live. I'm an Israeli. I live in Israel for all the goods and bads that entails, wrestling with a very difficult period of time, a government that I am very opposed to, a war that I had tremendous issues with, but a legacy that I am overall proud of and willing to defend. I'm a Westerner. That is, I'm someone who has been raised in a tradition that is, its roots are in the West and the global North. And I recognize the privileges that gives me, as well as the responsibilities and obligations that I believe that are entailed. And I'm a human. And I think in that order, you know, starting with a father. And so what was very interesting for me about when you told me about this podcast is that I fear that my children are entering into a world in which in every other identity of mine is getting worse. And I've made it my personal mission to do whatever I can in order to try to make it better.
Okay. That was going to be my question. Why did you start with that aspect of yourself, father?
I think of that all the time and every day.
And how does that unfold for your children? How do they receive that from you? What do you tell them? How do you tell it to them?
That's a really interesting question, because I'm not sure I do. I've been very fortunate with my life. I grew up in New York City, parents who were artists, living under the poverty line. Went to the best public schools and was fortunate enough to then continue on later in university with scholarships, built a few organizations, built a business that was sold and another business that made me enough money to not have to worry about everyday subsistence. So I'm very, very, very fortunate. Let's start there. When COVID hit and I found myself not flying anymore for work and, you know, and kind of hit my midlife crisis at 40, what I realized is the thing that was most important for me is to spend time with my kids. So it's not so much what I tell them, but it's that I'm there for them now in a way that I wasn't able to be before. I'm there when they wake up, and I'm there when they go to sleep, you know, and sometimes even there, you know, for lunch with them, because in Israel, kids come home at around 1:15, and I'm there with homework, and I'm there when they go to activities, and I try to do what I can in order to be there for them whenever else that they need me as well. So it's not so much what I say, but maybe there is an element of the stories that we tell and the conversations we have around the table, and but more importantly, the work that I try to do. So I think there's a balancing between being a father directly through my actions and my caregiving, and being a father in my professional work in terms of taking responsibility for the world around me and trying to better it through the work that I do when I'm not with my children.
How has that changed you? The fact that you've been for almost 5 years now, 5 years now, have spent significantly more time with the children. What has
Oh
that
God,
done
it's
to you?
changed me completely. You know, from 2000, I founded my first organization in 2005, Present Tense, and we were building accelerators and for social entrepreneurs in different cities around the world. And I was flying at least once a month. And my daughter was born in 2012, and in 2013, I hired management for Present Tense, and I was the founding CEO of Mobile ODT, of a med tech company that worked to diagnose cervical cancer in emerging markets. And there I was gone at least twice a month, you know, so half of my time from 2013 until 2020, I was away. And that was when my daughter was growing up, my other two sons were born. And I thought that that's just who I was. You know, I thought that who I was the guy who was on planes all the time and at conferences. And, you know, I'd fly across the African continent into Southeast Asia and China and East Europe and you know, Latin America. And that was just what I did because that was my mission, you know. But COVID and the fact that the investors in my previous company decided to sell it, got me to have a break. You know, it wasn't my choice. I probably wouldn't have, you know, I was addicted, right? And that grounded me, and it grounded me, you know, in the two different senses of the word. And it changed me completely in terms of, you know, in the Jewish tradition, there's the saying that when the children of Israel were leaving Egypt, they came to the Mount Sinai where the Torah, the teaching, the Bible was presented. And in response to that, they said a phrase, Na'aseh v'nishma, which is we will do and then we will listen. And the question and the sages ask is, what do you mean do and then listen? First you need to listen and then do. But that's how I feel it was for me. You know, I did and then I listened. You know, all of a sudden I found myself being more of a father, more of a parent, more involved, more there, more of a spouse, more of a community member because I was here. And it changed how I saw myself, how I saw the world, how I saw my responsibility. And it was a very formative experience for me.
How much does the, I mean, you mentioned both of your parents were or are artists, and you were living under the poverty line. You explicitly said that, which signals to me that that has significance to you. And I'm wondering how, what aspects of that life shaped your worldview. So the both the outlook and the perspective on the world through the eyes of artists, and the fact that you were living under the poverty line. What did that do?
It shaped me significantly. I mean, you know, we're not for rent control. Like I grew up in the middle of Manhattan. You know, so in what now is probably the most, you know, expensive real estate in the world. But my parents came to New York and were fortunate enough to come to a city that was giving working artists rent-controlled apartments. And if it wasn't for that and the public school system, then I wouldn't be where I am today. So one, I learned about the importance of the public sector and, what a government that wants to encourage the development of a community can and should do in order to allow people to develop. My dad likes to say, my dad was a painter at the time. My mom was a dancer. My dad, when we go to museums, my dad likes to say, look at what an institution was built on other people's suffering. Museums, like the artists that are making museums wealthy, that drive entire economies around them, all showcase the work of individuals that poured their heart and soul and pain and suffering into art. And they weren't, remunerated. They didn't earn massive amounts of money. They lived for their work. And the public benefits from it. And the public can give back in return. And that's the cultural life of a nation is what enriches the nation, what makes the nation, feel wealthy. I'm not talking money. I think money is an instrument. I'm talking about the real value of life. And so one, I learned about the importance and of what it means to have a social safety net, even though, I didn't grow up with health. I had no health insurance until I was in college, but I never really wanted for anything because we weren't people who grew up looking for objects as status symbols. And that shaped me who I am. Now, on the other hand, I became very practical as a person. So my whole career is about helping people who want to fix problems in the world do so on a financially sustainable model, right? That was what I did with Present Tense. We wanted to address cervical cancer and the fact that women were dying of a curable disease. And so we built a med tech company to do that. So with Covelocity, we worked with organizations to help transition their health systems in order to address COVID and then later to develop new innovations in their program areas in order to help solve the challenges they're facing. So my rebellion against, I guess, the artistic world is that I've become much more practical in my personal professional craft.
And with all of that, I mean, I'm going back to you define yourself as a father first in the light of the challenges we're facing as humanity. And your multi-perspectival view, since you've traveled the world, you've seen many cultures, you've seen many people. And that's the third vector, active doing, right? I wonder what does the hope for a good world look like for you? Right? So the outlines, the foggy horizon that you can see of, okay, this is where I'm headed. This is what it should be like for all of us 8, 9 billion on this planet, so that all of us can thrive. I'm wondering what might that look like for you?
Yeah, that's something I've thought about a lot because especially my work in mobility in emerging markets or developing countries where I the work that we did in cervical cancer was in the poorest of communities where women don't have access to labs or to gynecologists that where there are healthcare workers and nurses that do their screening and where a disease like cervical cancer, which should kill no one, kills still an obscenely large amount of women. And when I was there, it struck me, I keep on coming back to this, but I want, what I want to also point out, what I also want to say is that on one hand, going to impoverished areas was a lesson in the privilege that I enjoy. On the other hand, it was also a lesson in recognizing that the material conditions for happiness are not as high as I necessarily thought they would be. And what I mean by that is that in the Jewish tradition, there's a saying that kind of the messianic vision, so to speak, is each under their grapevine and under their fig tree, meaning for every person to have their own source of sustenance that is theirs, that they feel ownership over, that they feel a sense of agency over. I used to give these courses on visioning, and what I would say is that when the people of Israel left Egypt and went back to the land of their forefathers, as part of the Exodus story in the Bible, their promise was a land of milk and honey. And oftentimes in our kind of developed Western brains, we think that it's obviously you buy milk and honey in the store, right? But for an agrarian society, milk and honey are things that you have to care for. They're things that you have to invest time in, that you need to steward, that you need to feel ownership over. If you mess with the sheep, because at the time their milk was from sheep, or if you mess with the fig trees, because the fig trees are what gave you honey at the time, it wasn't or the dates, it wasn't bee honey, it wouldn't grow. If you didn't have enough water, if you didn't take care of the land, if you didn't know how to circle your crops, if you didn't know how to collaborate on keeping the pastures, then you just wouldn't have it. And that sense of that idea of ownership, of autonomy, of a sense of agency, that's what makes life not only possible, but it makes life meaningful because you build communities around that. You share common resources. You collaborate around the needs that each person in the community has. You can't live all on your own. The idea of rugged individualism presupposes that you have an entire infrastructure to allow you to be ruggedly individualist. For me, what I realized was that for me would be my hope, which is to create a world in which people recognize that they can trust one another and own. And I want to put a star on own because I'll talk about that in a second. But and own their own means of production, meaning to feel that they themselves can account for themselves, can rely on themselves to for sustenance. And why would I say own and rely on? Because these are kind of dangerous words at a certain level. I don't mean it in the rugged individualist, meaning me and nobody else. The opposite. I mean it is that I know that I can trust that by living in this community with people who share my values, who share my tradition, who share my understanding of what is a good life, that I can feel comfortable in the fact that I will be able to eat tomorrow, that I can invest in the future and making and enriching the future for my children and for my grandchildren, that I can build a world, a small world, meaning a world for ourselves that allows us to explore who we are. And I think that's something that we've kind of lost as a culture that has gotten so obsessed with, growth and materialism and things that are disconnected from that kind of that healthy, what I think is a healthy sense of sustainability, stability, permanence that doesn't really exist anymore.
I would describe this in the words of a friend in the Johar as a situation of mutually assured thriving, where you store the surplus of what you generate for your life in the bellies of your community. And because everybody else does the same, you know that you will be taken care of if your crop fails or if something else happens.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. It's an obsession with the social strength as opposed to an obsession with your personal strength. It puts you at a different place. It doesn't take away your individualism, but it recognizes that your individual thriving is part of the collective thriving. I agree.
In that, how do you think about satisfying more complex needs that you might want to satisfy as a community that you cannot source directly in your, let's say, bioregion, right? I don't know, glass. So there needs to be some commerce that expands out of the, or maybe that doesn't, I don't know. But how do you think
Look,
about that?
I'm a student of Martin Buber in that regards. Martin Buber was a philosopher and political philosopher in the late 19th, early 20th century. He's best known for the whole I and thou concept of dialogue and recognizing the specialness of others. But his early work was on anarcho-syndicalism, which means the self-determination of communities and their interactions with one another. And the difference between anarchism and anarcho-syndicalism, which is a really big word, but all it really means is that that we govern ourselves and we work together with others who govern themselves. And that's the basis for my belief in self-determination, which is that once you know that you need other people, then your community knows it needs other communities. But the work with other communities is not a means of taking away your right to self-determination. It's a mutuality that occurs voluntarily because both communities know that they can benefit from the interaction with one another. It's an interaction based on a mutual recognition as opposed to dominance. And that's what I believe in. I just believe that the world would be a better place if we could find it in ourselves to recognize each other's humanity, and help one another because we too would want to be helped when we need help.
There is a when I have conversations with people literally all over the planet around their dream of a good world, they usually give me a version of what you just described. And it relies on the 98% of us who are not in the dark triad modality to actually work together. Now, you will always, in any population, find roughly 2% dark triad people, meaning people who are whose psychology is dominated by the triad between Machiavellism, psychopathy, and narcissism. And these people are very, very useful in times of crisis because they will do anything to succeed, right? So this is why. Likely they survived the evolutionary pressure, which should be adverse to that kind of behavior. But since they're sometimes useful, they're good. Now, the problem is that if you have a bioregion with multiple communities that act like you just described, and they're in a mutual support and it's fractal up until, I don't know, the whole nation, maybe even, then, just one community that starts using their resources to arm themselves and then go rob the others will poison the well, right? So what is your take on down-regulating that kind of behavior?
I don't know. I mean, I've been struggling with that. I'll tell you, I've really been struggling with that. I can tell it through the story of what's happened in Israel, where you can look at the narrative of the Israeli Palestinian conflict in many different directions. I personally see it as a civil war. I see it as two peoples that have a deep connection to this land, who are trying to find a way to determine their destiny. And are more than willing to hurt the other in order to capture as much of it as they can get. And I think that if you look at the majority of the population, they would be able to live completely at peace with one another. For the majority of the population, you could come to an agreement. People have done that all over the world. In Germany, you know better than anyone. In Costa Rica as well. Across the world, people know what it's like to get into wars and to lose some and to gain some and to just realize that it's not worth fighting. Let's figure it out. But here we have, like you said, it's a little more perhaps of the population that are on both sides unwilling to just live. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to bridge that gap. I know that it has been done, maybe not successfully for long periods of times, And what I'm trying to do as best I can is to find means of strengthening the people who are more intent on self-determining than determining for others.
So what I learned in that respect from people like Tyson, Yunker Porta, and other First Nations or First Peoples people is that in old times the modality of down regulation was if a community discovered dark triad personality types in a child or in a young person, they would try to help this person heal from this, to regulate it themselves. If that didn't work, then the cascade would be to potentially send them out of the community, like expel them from the community, which is akin to a death sentence in many cases, or even go that step themselves and kill them. So there was deep awareness of the danger of this kind of personality type, whereas in our current modality of how we run civilization, we actually upregulate this kind of person, right? So dark triad at the moment is you find about 10 to 20% in so-called leadership positions are dark triad. Because of the way we think about how to do economy. And what I'm hearing from your model is that since it's constituted in an entirely different modality, it tends to upregulate the opposite of dark triad. And there might be a hope that through that modality, the community is strong enough to downregulate the dark triad types by themselves. That's what I
Yeah, I mean,
sense, but I'm not sure.
no, I'm not sure
Go ahead.
either. I mean, I think you ask a really good question. My father, a number of years ago, started studying and became a shaman, a witch doctor in the Ecuadorian, in the Andean tradition. It's a yachak, he's called. And so he works quite a lot with different tribes in the Amazon and the Andes, in Peru and Brazil. And it's interesting because his experience with them, which is similar to experience that I've had, but was somewhat different in on the African continent or in India, is that many of the kind of the indigenous societies were very violent. And so kind of what you shared about, being willing to, take people out, doesn't surprise me. But they also went to war regularly, and that was how they regulated the local population. The shuar that he works with, or the sequoia that he works with, they used to eat each other. Like literally, they used to go to war every once in a while. There are too many people. The resources were low in that section of the forest, and the winner would literally eat the loser as a means of, respecting them and bringing their. But my point is that I don't think humanity has figured that part out, and I think that again, in the Hebrew tradition, there's this concept of, the potential for good is also the potential for bad, and vice versa. The same energy that drives people to do good can also drive people to do bad. And so I think that we've just gotten so much more energy as a society, and as the developed world, so to speak, has amassed this surplus and is just so intent on increasing it. And I don't know whether it has to do with punishing individuals so much as it's changing the social circumstances within those individuals operate. I'd like to think it's the second, meaning I'd like to think that instead of punishing individuals, what we need is a society that's strong enough to stand up to individuals when they overstep their bounds and just not let them do it. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, the work that I try to do is to support people who are building those institutions that can help their communities and strengthen their communities and building a world that is fairer and more available to everyone. But it's a really good question. I have to think about that. I'll think about it a lot more.
Well, I fully agree with the idea that we are a symptom of our environment, and therefore the question that follows that, and you just started going into that direction, so let's take that, is what do you see, and then what do you do, because you're a doer, towards helping us create an environment that becomes more conducive towards the ultimate dream that you just laid out for us. What's a concrete action on the ground that you're unfolding so that this becomes a more real possibility?
So what I'm doing right now, so let's take a step back. After the war start, the most recent war started here in our region, what I came to believe was that we were too focused on short-term thinking and reaction, and we weren't thinking long-term enough to the future we want to arrive at. And I believed that, and I still believe that, were we to think 30 years ahead, 50 years ahead, and try to identify the world we want to live in, we'd be able to make much smarter decisions in the present. And I think that having a conversation about what's 30 years ahead, 50 years ahead, would be much more productive than having a conversation about what is right now and who's responsible for it. And so what I started to do is to run workshops on futures thinking for organizations and executives to help them to develop those tools. But then I realized that it was very limiting in terms of my time. So what I did, I'm editing and publishing a journal called Prophecy, whose goal is to expand the political imagination by getting people used to even thinking and speaking in that language. And so that's what I'm personally doing, which is I believe that meaning where I can believe that I can currently contribute most is by helping to shift the way that we think about ourselves and the decisions we make. And my aspiration there is to have that enter into the policymaker slash business and civil society mentality. Whether it'll happen, I don't know. But I find it to be very interesting. I find the conversations that have resulted to be very fresh and different than what you generally see in the media. Whether it's has to do with things on climate or whether it has to do with things with our relationships with our neighbors and our region, whether it has to do with our relationship with ourselves. When you think ahead, it changes what you think may be possible. And then on a professional level, I continue to work with organizations to help them build future-oriented strategy, future anchored strategy. But it takes that's more retail as opposed to kind of the journal, which is more wholesale. It just allows for more people to enter into the conversation. And I know that's weak, like I wish I could do more at a certain level. I mean, like I would very much like to do more, but I'm taking it step by step right now to try to figure out because I don't have answers to the questions that you've asked that are convincing enough for myself. So
Well, I don't think it's weak. I think what I hear at least is you're contributing what many people are looking for is narratives in one way, but also there are new concepts emerging that are hard to pinpoint. They require words, right? And The first step is to define the concepts, but then to find words for those concepts that then become commonly used so that we can point towards those complex concepts and start playing with them, and by doing so, increase the adjacent possible of what we can actually think in the world, right? And as we do this, then new things become possible. And it takes a lot of courage to do this. I think everybody should once a year read a couple of things. One is Meditations on Moloch, but the other one is 50 Years Hence by Winston Churchill. In, I think, 1932, the guy sat down and wrote this really, really crazy essay on how he envisioned the world to be in 50 years. And there were chicken wings growing in shelves and cellars running on solar energy. There were autonomous cars. There was solar energy. There were so many crazy things that are now happening or have been happening for a while now. And I cannot even begin to imagine what his contemporaries must have thought about him reading this craziness, right? And so it takes enormous courage to engage in these truly radical, in the sense that they are rooted in the current science, the current best understanding, and unfolding from there into what might feel like sci-fi, but ultimately might come to pass. How do you help the people to have that courage?
First of all, I haven't read 50 Years Hence, so I look forward to reading it.
Yeah.
I've read, I mean, I'm an avid reader of sci-fi, and you know, one of the essays around that time that was written that I think about almost every day is John Maynard Keynes on his vision for the future of the economy, where how he thought that his grandchildren's world. Or the world of our grandchildren, more correctly, which is because he, I'm not sure if he, no, I think he did have kids, but I'm not sure. And what he wrote about was that there would be a 15-hour work week, you know, that the economy would get so efficient that we'd have 15-hour work weeks and people would spend most of their time doing leisure. And obviously, as we know, that absolutely did not come to pass because people just created more and more bullshit jobs to feel busy at. And we started, integrating information technologies into our everyday lives, not for leisure, but for work to feel productive. And so I think about the like you said, which I love, the adjacent possible and how ideas are what drive us to decide where we're going to put our resources, what we value, how we define our time, and so on. So I'll tell you, for the journal, what I've been doing. We've only published two journals so far. Our third, we're working on the third one right now. I have 15 contributors per journal. It's small. It's not huge readership. It's about 5,000 readers a month. And the way that we bring people into it is through conversation. So I've had. I started by asking people to write for it, and I had a whole series of questions and contributor guidelines. What I learned was that it was better to have a conversation with them, and to push them on many of the things that you pushed me, but in this case, much more practically on a specific subject, to ask them a series of questions that Michael Walzer, the political theorist, asked in his book Exodus and Revolution, which he said, you know, wherever you are, it's probably Egypt. There is a better place, and it's a promised land. And there's only one way to get there. It's through the wilderness, by linking arms and marching. And so I asked them, you know, what's the imperfect present that you're grappling with, and what would be a future in which it would be solved, and then how do you think that we should get there? And by leading them through a conversation in those three phases, we oftentimes stumble on the future. Because even though it's much more practically oriented, it's still very difficult for people to imagine a world that's not the world that we're living in today. And I've limited it to 10 years with them for the because it's just harder for them to think even further afield. So we generally limit it to 10 years in the future. I mean, where do you think the field could be 10 years from now if we did everything right? And it's tough. It's funny because it's not easy. You would think that it would be relatively easy for people who are activists in a space to think about what they want that space to look like upon their success, but it's actually very hard. I found it to be very hard for them to define victory. So that work, that process that we go through is a fascinating one for me. I hope it's also interesting for them. And I think for the readers, so I'll give you just a few examples of some of the kind of visions that came out. The article that we published last week, from the moment where you and I are speaking, was an article in which a woman who works across the African continent spoke about how Africa right now is undergoing a colonial land grab by China, who's extracting amazing amount of resources. Both the UAE and Saudi Arabia, as well as the United States, are all trying to get back into Africa, seeing China's success, let alone European countries. And what she said was that from her experience, and I can see this also from my work in a few African countries, the difference between Israeli partnerships with African countries and the partnerships and kind of the work that the Chinese try to do there or the Americans try to do there is that Israelis generally sell knowledge, where the Chinese buy and Americans buy resources. Israel isn't an industrial economy in the same way. We don't need to buy heavy metals or rare earth material. We don't manufacture. And so we're not extractive in that regards. And her pitch was that the African continent is a continent that is growing faster than any other continent. Human needs there are greater. They're going to be affected by climate change more than anyone else. Israel has incredible knowledge when it comes to agriculture, water management, biotechnology. And what we should be doing is we should be devoting ourselves not to the global north, but to the global south. And that vision of a partnership between Israel and Africa is a vision that you don't hear often in Israel. And she really sketched it out and how it would look. I found that very compelling. I found it beautiful. For another example is I spoke with a man who is the editor and publisher of of Israel's leading a business paper. And he's been speaking about the dangers of social networks for years now, and how the algorithmic process dehumanizes and is extractive and causes us to fight one another more and so on, and political violence and all that. And asked him what's the future that he sees. And he actually went back into the past. He said, 100 years ago, there were mines where children, I mean, in the developed world, it still happens across Africa and Southeast Asia and so on, but in the United States and Europe, there were mines that parents would send their kids to work in. Why? Because that's what they needed to do. They went to work in the mines in order to pay the bills. And he said that he hopes that victory for him is when people realize that right now our children are working in big tech's mines. That they're mining value for them as opposed to living healthy lives. And what he wants is a new way of thinking about human health and well-being that recognizes the extractive damage that's done by social networks. It was interesting. It's a different way of thinking about the big technology companies that define so much of our lives. So, that kind of, but it was hard to get there. It wasn't as clear of a vision. It wasn't as much of a future that we could that he can easily define. And that process of getting to there, of trying to understand what's a metaphor, what's an idea that we could circle around and say that, that's a victory. Victory for him was just a democratic future in which people recognize that algorithms can't be extractive and that humans should be human health that should be primary. that was the future he could imagine at that moment. I hope though that that as we continue, we'll get better at helping people think about the adjacent possible, defining what they think of as a definition of victory, inspire one another in order to have those conversations. I hope very much, and I'm still looking for, because of me being in my, we do have a Palestinian voice for this next issue, but I'm hoping to make it more balanced in that regard, so that we have people from all over the region sharing their visions of the future. And maybe from that, we'll be able to find a future we all can agree to and start working towards it.
Just a side note to the land grabbing issue. There's a movie called The Grab, which is a documentary on that thing happening across Africa and other parts of the planet. And it's not only China, it's everybody in the industrialized world really trying to grab hold onto resources across the planet. So it's really, really informative, this one, the grab. I really recommend that.
Thank you.
There's a so I love the examples you gave, and at the same time, I can feel that they're extrapolations from the current modality, right? The 10-year frame is helpful. Let's step out of where we are, but it always feels like you're tied to the current constraints, and it's hard to imagine within the 10-year time frame to really step out of this. You mentioned Keynes, and around about the same time, Churchill wrote with a horizon of 50 or maybe even more years in the Keynes article. How do you see people responding to that? And have you had any experience with people going beyond the 10-year horizon? Does that change the stories they tell, or what happens there?
So I really wanted to start something called a 50-year club,
Okay.
which was all about that, which is literally let's look far beyond the imagined moment, the imagined future, something that you might not live to experience. And let's imagine, what our kids will look like in late middle age, what our grandkids would look like. And I failed. I completely failed. And I wrote my own essay for how what I believe the grand strategy should be for Israel, 25 years into the future, and people couldn't handle it. It was too much. It was too far away from what they believed was possible. And so that's why I fell back to the 10. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that the, my Something I would love to do, was to publish more science fiction, more, but like near future, practical science fiction that looks at possibilities of where we can go. I'm a big fan of solar punk. My critique of solar punk is that it's very local in its thinking. And what I'm interested in are, I mean, there are people that do this work, but I'm interested in thinking, like you said, far enough ahead that you can be a little fantastical, but not local, not so much local as in particular to a specific space, but rather thinking about the larger human condition at that moment. Obviously told through a story, but or a series of stories, but something grander. I haven't found that yet. I mean, I just haven't. Not yet. And that's my own, inability to do the work in the way that I'd like to. But I agree with you. I think that's where things need to go.
But I don't know, it was 2017, I think. I bumped into this Winston Churchill article, and I wanted to do something similar, have a publication for people imagining their future. I couldn't find anybody who was willing to do so because everybody was scared of the response of the rest of the world, right? That's it's like a downward spiral of silence. Everybody thinks that everybody else would think you're crazy, so you're not saying it. But what I discovered, when you start saying it, then you'll find more agreement than not, usually. And the experiment I then conducted, and I did this for a couple of years, was to collect privately, to collect articles of people, friends of mine, about their hope for the world in 50 years or more, 70, I think it was even 70, and then collect them into a little book, and then share that book only with contributors. So you were among a peer group of people who actually contributed to this. And that worked a lot better. But unfortunately, you cannot reach a large audience with that. But it created a kernel of courage that maybe expanded from there. I know some people who have gone on to do things that were a little bit more outrageous than they might have done if they hadn't had that mutual reinforcement. So that was my response, but I really see that it is very, very difficult, but also quite needed, especially in a time where we are confronted with exponentials in both directions, right? The good and the bad. And we urgently need to make sense of it and not be carried with it, but rather be in agency. So right now you are focused on the region you're in, right? Am I hearing that correctly? You're focused on with prophecy, you're focused on Israel plus
Yeah, I mean,
and
right now we are we're just going through such a tumultuous and terrible period that my first interest is in trying to solve. My first interest is trying to contribute towards solutions towards to where we are. Not to say that it's the right thing to do, but this is where I live. This is the people that I'm amongst. I am a product of my tradition, and I believe in self-determination. So this is where I'm focused right now. It's very different than where I was focused for years, and so, but it's what I'm doing. But I would love to work with others that are trying to do the same for their own communities. For a while now, I've been on and off conversations with different people in different countries, in what I call what I call an alliance of the ancients. I believe there are a few societies that are ancient societies. They're societies that have collective histories, memories that they keep alive through traditions for thousands of years. And there's something very interesting about that that's very difficult to communicate to cultures that have memories that are only a few hundred years. And so at some point I'd love to dig more into that question of ancientness and what that means, and what is it, what can we learn from traditions that have survived for such a long period of time and aren't willing to just disappear. What's the value in there? What are the constrictions? What are the futures that are possible for such traditions that have such a weight of history? That's interesting for me as well.
I'm going to connect you with my friends from Australia, AIM Imagination, who are building on a 60,000-year tradition on unbroken song line to help us all understand how we get back into relation, right? So that's very, very aligned with what you're saying. Now, the reason why I was asking about the context, because what you're doing is very, very context specific, and is the question, the critique you had for solar punk is is also rooted there. It's solar punk tries to be very context specific and doesn't have real responses of how to grow out of that in a dispositional way for all of humanity. And the what I'm hearing is that your response to that, growing out of that and into a global disposition, lies in creating alliances with other groups like yourselves who are working in their specific context, but seeing the parallels between them and building on top of those parallels as a means of integrating what it might be commonalities that are true for all of us. Is that right? Am I hearing that correctly?
Yeah, I mean that's the kind of that's the anarcho-syndicalist inside me, right? Which is
Okay,
that
yeah,
I don't
makes
believe there is
sense.
a universal. I think that I think that there are people who believe in the universal, just they're not willing to admit that they're imperialists. You know, that their particular views, they believe their particular views should be everyone's views. I don't think that my views should be everyone's views. You know, I mean, my people has been a small people in a region that's been contested for thousands of years. And, you know, wherever we went around the world, we recognized that we were different. And that's not a bad thing. But for a long time, you know, universalism, whether it be Christian universalism or Islamic universalism or Enlightenment universalism, Western universalism, imagine that there was one truth that everyone should agree to. I don't think that that's true. I think that we have different cultures with different truths, different values, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be able to work together. I think that it is a good thing for communities to self-determine, to define what they value, and to recognize that by working together, they can do so much more than if they're competing with one another or trying to convince one another that their truth is the right truth. So that's my basic belief of. You know, of the good of society. But you know, that's me.
I hear that a lot, and at that point in the conversation, I usually ask myself why we hear that mostly from men, because I think it's a very, very inherently feminine way of looking at the world. I experienced that in several different ways, that the way of scaling out in the tradition that you were just describing as the universal answers is like Facebook or Google will create one solution that's big enough, make that big enough to fit this to planet, whereas I experienced many times that the feminine version of this is to say, I have a solution that works for me. Here it is. Why don't you go and adapt it to your environment or your context and see if it works and then pass it on. And I'm missing the female voice in all of this. And every time I many of the times I invite the female voice into conversations like this, I get a no because of the disposition that you were just describing, saying, who am I to say something universal, right? So at that point in the conversation, I always think, maybe us men should just shut up for a while and to see what the women have to say.
Well, that's for
But I'm
sure.
unsure
That's
about
without a
that.
question. Shutting up is not a bad thing. Yeah. Look, men are traditionally, culturally, in our culture for sure, more willing to be wrong, you know, to say things that might be wrong. And that's just an education thing. I'm with you. I mean, well, you know, it's when I facilitate strategic conversations, the way that I try to account for that is by having everyone first write down what it is that they are thinking, and then to go around where people read what they're thinking, so that we don't give primacy to people who are, you know, able to just jump forward and just start talking and thinking while they're talking. But it's really hard when you're doing it as a podcast, or you're doing, or you're getting people to try to write articles. It's really tough. I'm with you on that.
So we discovered some probable universality in the sense that I at least find on the planet and speak with seems to have a very similar dream about the world. Yet the concrete implementation is very context-based, right? So it's very different in Israel compared to anywhere else in the world. So it's a coherent kind of pluralism, right? There's a coherent core to what it means to be a
Well,
human being
that's what I
and
was about to say. You know,
good.
yeah, I think that's something that, sorry, that's something that is interesting, right? The plurality aspect of it, I think, is what binds it together. It's the mutual recognition and mutual respect of self-determination. So it's not universal in that. You know, everyone's going to take it in the direction that they find to be the right way to take it, and that's a good thing. So there's a certain maturity to it at a certain level. You know, it's not for nothing that most of the great empires were built by younger people. You know, they're younger because they think that they know everything and they go out to conquer the world. When you get a little older, you realize that it's okay. You know, you're going to be limited. There are things that you can do, things that you can't do. You know, you start caring about your kids and not only about your accomplishments. Obviously, it's not 100% true because the United States right now has a, you know, guy in his late 70s who's trying to force everyone to do what he wants. So old people don't really have the answers either. But I do think that there is an aspect of maturity to recognize that difference is not a bad thing, but a good thing. And that's not a, it's not a universal thing. It's a recognition of the dignity of difference, as you know, as Rabbi Jonathan Sacks used to say, or like you said, the plurality. Andy Tang has this whole concept of the plurality that I love as well.
So I'd like to know what other things you see that need to be doing beyond what you're doing. Usually I ask that question as a question of what would the other aerial clones do if you could clone yourself? But I'm going to give it a twist based on what you just said. Because we don't want mid-40s aerials. We want young, energized, full of themselves, 20-year-old aerials doing the work. What would a bunch of 20-year-old aerial clones do in the world? What's missing? What needs to be done?
So, you asked me before about, you know, if I could clone myself, and I said that I don't think I knew, but I want to take that back because you just phrased it in a way that made it easier for me to answer, which is that, you know, before the war and before the attempt by our current government to destroy our liberal democracy, I was very active in two different areas. Well, maybe three actually, that I wish that if I could have someone work on that right now, if I could work on it without giving up what I'm doing right now, then I would. The first area is reindustrialization for regenerative economies. I believe that we need to fundamentally shift our relationship with technology. And I believe that the way to do so is by building productive communities and thinking about how the city can become a productive community. And I had a whole plan and vision for something I called Generation, which was supposed to be a approach for how a city can take on the internal transformation to develop new programs for innovation that would transform the city into a generator, into a productive community that helps to create better balance between itself and its ecology. So that was the first thing. And then when the judicial overhaul in Israel started, I started to get very concerned about democracy, and the way that our current media ecosystem was giving tools to authoritarians to take over our governance. And I built a venture builder model, a venture studio model for what I call JETRO, which was a venture studio for democracy technologies. And I started to raise money for it. I had a team, and then the war happened. So, if someone could work on that, I'd love to be involved in that. I think there's some great efforts around the world. But we really need to solve for that. I mean, that's something we really need to solve for, because the power that these tools provide a very small number of people is I think detrimental to all of us. And then the last thing, which kind of wraps those two together, is before the war, I was applying for PhD programs in innovation research, because over the 20 years of my career helping other people build social ventures, building my own mission-driven companies, what I realized was that the way that we currently finance innovation is broken. It's based on a capitalist mindset that does not help the public good. It's extractive to the public good. I've done a lot of work in researching and reading about it. I wrote a book that I probably will never publish called VC is Bad for Your Health, about how the venture capital industry hurts healthcare and other what I call essential technologies, or technologies that are essential to human well-being. And I explained why the dynamics of fund structure and how they build portfolios and the power law and other kind of, insider terms and of the VC industry leads people to make bad decisions. So if I could do that, I'd love to. I'm publishing an article very soon in an academic journal on innovation taxonomy, and I'd like to follow up with a few others, but I didn't have the time to pursue the PhD and to kind of really make that a practice. So yeah, so I mean those are just three things. I would love, I mean, there are actually more things too, I mean, but I feel like that the way that we relate, the way that we think of our lived communities as productive units that are able to care for their needs, the way that we think about how we communicate and how our communications infrastructure affects our communities and how we work together as communities, and the way that we build platforms to develop new approaches to solving intractable problems are all things that I think need to happen. And I try, I'd love to be involved in those in the future, but right now, because of the war, because of the particular situation we're in, I'm trying to start with the imagination side before going into any of the other things.
That all makes a lot of sense, and it seems to me that it has two main directions. One is deepening the understanding, and deepening the thinking, which is one part of the vehicle that you're building of prophecy. But at the same time, building the infrastructure that the understanding requires. So, and I think building what you're building is a very wise decision, because it might inspire other people to do exactly that, to go and build the infrastructure that we all need for what we here would call Weltaufgang, but for a life-serving civilization, for a beautiful world for all life on this planet. So with that, I want to thank you not only for this really, really beautiful time together here, but for your work on behalf of all of us, so that we all find ways towards a good way of doing life on this planet. Thank you, man.